Welcome to another episode of the Alcon Addiction Podcast. My name is Lee Davey. I am not an alcoholic. I refuse to be anonymous. I'm someone that doesn't drink alcohol, and I spend every waking moment of my life helping other people do the same. I want to start out by saying a well done to Brent and Duncan for finishing the taster, and to Mike, who's currently working alongside Laurie in the last ever taster that anybody will experience in its current format. Yes, things are changing at Strive and the truth about alcohol. And I just want to share with you the primary reasons why we're going to be changing. First of all, most importantly, actually, not enough people are taking the intensive, right? And that for me is a travesty because it is such a life-changing experience. The evidence suggests that if you go through the taster, you are much more likely. The probability is much higher that you'll emerge as someone that doesn't drink alcohol, right? And I hoped that people would take the taster, and then after experiencing what it's like to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol for a month, then they would want that to make it permanently, and they would then take the intensive. But that's not happened, and the numbers are really low for people taking the intensive, and the numbers are really high for people taking the taster and accomplishing the goal of being someone that doesn't drink alcohol for the month. Feedback is really difficult to get. People don't like to be honest with me and tell me why they're not taking the intensive. My gut feel is it's the price leap. So the taster is £100. The intensive is £1,000. I think what happens is the taster is that good. People finish it and they get so confident feeling they're never going to drink again after a month that they don't feel that they need to spend the £1,000 on the intensive. So they join Strive for £5 a month and they kind of get through like that. But as the six stages of change shows through James and Janice Protraska's work, the period of maintenance when it comes to any kind of form of addiction can take anywhere up to 3 to 5 years. And I think it's really important that we understand that to actually recover from being someone who drinks a lot of alcohol or being someone who doesn't, it's going to take a long time. It's a long time commitment, okay? And that is something that's really, really super important for me, okay? So we need to get more people on the intensive. The other thing is I've always wanted a single platform with everybody singing from the same hymn sheet, right? I want people on Strive to all be talking about the same thing. So when somebody on Strive is talking about the death effect or talking about the value proposition or talking about Plato's allegory of the cave and why it's important to our philosophy, I want everybody to understand what everybody's talking about. And that currently doesn't happen because we have some people who are paying £5 a month to be members of Strive. We have some people who have access to taster materials but don't have access to intensive materials. And then we have a few people who have access to everything, right? So I want to change that. I want everybody to have access to the same stuff. I don't want Strive and Truth About Alcohol to be focused on helping people quit alcohol, right? I know that sounds a bit paradoxical, right? But for me, I've always said that becoming someone that doesn't drink alcohol through the philosophy of the truth about alcohol is much different than someone just saying on New Year's Eve, I'm never going to drink again, right? For me, what is missing out there is there's a gap out there for lifetime commitment, a lifetime module, a lifetime program. And that's what I want to introduce here at the Truth About Alcohol and Strive, right? Because we are going to need help, maybe not now, but what about 3 to 4 or 5 years on the line, right? I remember when I got divorced, I relapsed for a month after 3 years. If I had been a member of a group like this when I relapsed, my relapse would probably only lasted a day. As it happened because I was on my own, it lasted a month. And I want to change that, right? I want Strive and the Truth About Alcohol. I want the people who join it to be people who are focusing on a lifetime of personal growth and connections, okay? I want to help people create new communities with growth at the epicenter of that. There is a common theme here that when people stop drinking alcohol, they get very lonely. They find it really difficult to meet new friends. Yet at Strive, we're like family, man. And if we all lived around the corner from each other, we'd have the most beautiful relationships and connections that we've ever had in our lives. I want to create that in a permanent setting, okay? And it doesn't work the way it currently sits. I also want to create a hub of epic content, right? Epic content. And I don't want to be the only person creating it. Now, if you ask anybody who's taken the intensive or taken the taster, they will all tell you that this is, in their eyes, world-class, top quality, very different teachings and coachings around alcohol, this alcohol problem, okay? But would you rather listen to me talking about the efficacy of CBT or David Burns? Or would you like me to teach you about codependency? Or do you want Melody Beattie to teach you about codependency? Or do you want me to teach you about the drinker versus non-drinker kind of relationship problem that we have? Or would you like Melanie Joy to be teaching you that straight out of her book, Beyond Beliefs, right? Now, to attract these type of people who could create really world-class coaching modules for people who want to have a lifetime of personal growth, but it's connected to alcohol as well, then we have to pay them, right? We have to have the resources to pay them, and we need to have them want to be with us, so we need to up our game, okay? We need to up our game. Also, we need to move away from the ambassador-controlled group learning to peer group learning and self-learning, right? Because the former just isn't scalable presently. We don't have enough ambassadors, right? We really struggle. If we have too many people want to take the taste or the intensive, we don't have enough ambassadors, okay? Now, when we do have enough ambassadors in the future, and I know this works because I've seen this work on Seth Godin's courses, okay? When we do have enough ambassadors, now we can have a merge then of ambassadors, right? Really highly kind of like experienced people helping you and the peer group learning as well. But when that happens, I want our ambassadors to be highly skilled and well paid, okay? And that costs money as well. So with this in mind, the taster and the intensive programs are going to be on hold until I introduce a new subscription model. The cost is going to be £40 per month, which back in my day was a cost of 3 bottles of cheap wine for a tenner every Friday night. And think about this, okay? People might say, oh, £40 is a lot. £40 is a lot of money. 1 year no beer, only charge £200 a year or whatever. If you are able to stop drinking through the philosophy that we are teaching you at Trooper Alcohol, this lifetime philosophy of never having to crave, have to worry about alcohol, you will be saving between £10,000 and £15,000 a year, okay? Just having a massage these days costs you £100. I'm sitting down in front of a therapist just talking about stuff costs you £100, okay? Your cable probably costs you £40 a month. This is a lifetime of top quality content, growth, and community for £40 a month. I think personally is a steal, okay? Now, you can still join Strive for £5 a month, but the price will increase to £40 as soon as I pull my finger out my ass and finish updating the website, all the programs. Because what is going to happen, to be clear, for this £40 a month, is you'll get access to Strive, and you'll get access to all of our trainer modules. Think of Strive and the Truth About Alcohol as being the new Netflix of addiction philosophy around alcohol and personal self-growth emerging from that, okay? So you'll have all the taster modules, all the intensive modules, and anything else I or any other coach creates in the future. And you can always switch it off whenever you like. So if you join for £40 a month and after the first month you look around and you think, I don't like Lee's content, you can leave. You can just cut it off, right? Or maybe you stay 3 to 4 months and then you think you can go alone. You don't need to be love lifetime content. Then you can turn that off again. So that's going to be the future. If you've got any questions on any of that whatsoever, then send me an email at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll explain them to you. Anyway, on to our next guest, Dr. Will Cole. Dr. Will Cole is leading functional medical expert and he consults people around the world via webcam at www.drwillcole.com and locally in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He specializes in clinically investigating underlying factors of chronic disease and customizing health programs for thyroid issues, autoimmune conditions, hormonal dysfunctions, digestive disorders, and brain problems. Dr. Cole was named as one of the top 50 functional medicine and integrative doctors in the nation and is an alpha expert for MindBody Green and Goop. Dr. Cole is the author of the book Ketotarian, which is where I found him, in which he melds the most powerful benefits of the ketogenic diet with a plant-based one. I got Dr. Will Cole on. Sorry, I got a bit of a cough and there's a fly buzzing around my head as well, if you can hear it. I got Dr. Cole on because there are a lot of people on Strive who are taking the ketotarian diet or who have tried the ketotarian diet, right? And the things we touch upon in this episode are how the ketogenic diet improves brain function and decreases chronic inflammation, the interaction of genes and our environment, where alcohol fits into the ketogenic lifestyle, the importance of drinking water, and we also have a word on the conflicting advice given by the hugely popular medical medium Anthony Williams, because as you know, in the ketogenic diet, it's all about eating lots of fat. And then if you read anything by the medical medium Anthony Williams, it's all about a let's not eat too much fat, right? So we have a good talk about that at the end. So there you are, big long intro. I know, again, if you've got any questions whatsoever on the taste of the intensive or strive or where we're going, email me at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. And until then, I'll leave you in the capable hands of Dr. Will Cole.
Welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast, Dr. Will Cole. How's life?
Life is blessed, man. Thanks for asking me. How's your life?
My life is absolutely chaotically blessed.
Love it. So, yeah, that's a lot of, I get that. Busyness can be good.
I see a lot of certificates on your wall back there. That looks like a lot of hard work.
Yeah, that's part of the blessing, right? It's like hard work, putting your time in and wanting to expand your knowledge base and how you can help people. So yeah, it's a lot of years there.
Tell us a little bit about your background then, so people who are not quite aware of who you are, just give us kind of like the nutshell kind of back history.
Sure. Yeah, so I'm a functional medicine practitioner. Today is my case review day, hence the not doctor wear. I'm not wearing my doctor clothes today. So I do case reviews on these days, and where I kind of do deep dive with the team and making sure the patients have everything that they need. We primarily have a virtual clinic. So we see patients around the world via webcam consultations at drwillcole.com. So my doctorate's from Southern California University of Health Sciences in Los Angeles. My postdoctorate education and training is in functional medicine and clinical nutrition. I'm one of mindbodygreen.com's, one of their course instructors and wellness experts. So I do teaching virtually as well. And I do similar work for Goop as well, which are two of the largest wellness brands in the world. And yeah, I have a book called Ketotarian, which is a mostly plant-based ketogenic book, and it's out everywhere. It came out end of last year. And I have my second book coming out in October of this year, called The Inflammation Spectrum. And that's on pre-sale, pre-order now. So that's my stuff. That's professional stuff. And then personally, I have my lovely wife of almost 14 years at this point and two kids. And that's my life.
You sound like a very different doctor than we would experience on the National Health Service in the UK.
Yeah, I'm not your general NHS GP for sure. We do something different in functional medicine. My job is to get to the root cause, find out why you're going through what you're going through, which isn't a medication deficiency for the most part, right? What is the root cause of why you're going through what you're going through? So we use the best advancements of labs, and then we customize healthcare to the individual. So it's really the best of Western medicine, which is being evidence-based and objective and being clinical and using the best information we have out there in the form of research. And then the best of alternative health, which is actually getting somebody healthy and not just giving them more medications and with really no end in sight. So it is personalized alternative medicine.
Yeah, it is. It is really strange. And, when listening to you talk, it's really encouraging, actually, because, if I ever go to the doctors in the UK and tell them there's something wrong with me, it's not unheard of for them to say, well, what have you figured out? Like, normally I got a doctor and I've done a bit of Google research beforehand. And it's not unusual for the doctor to say, well, what did Google tell you, mate? And then we have a conversation and then they give me some pills and off I go. And whenever I say to them, well, what's causing this then? The question I normally get back is, oh, it could be a wide variety of things. And like I have hypothyroidism, for example. And there's nobody in the health service that I go and see that is remotely interested in figuring out why I've got hypothyroidism. All they want to do is give me level thyroxine or some other drugs in order for me to go back and have tests and they're equal X, Y, Z, right? So, you know, thank you for what you do. I think it needs to be the future of medicine, really, especially the personalized stuff, you know.
Oh, certainly. And there's a place for conventional medicine. We just asked in functional medicine, we asked the question, what is your most effective option that causes you the least amount of side effects? And for some people, a medication, they fit that criteria. But for most people, it's not the most effective option. It causes them a lot of potential side effects, but yet that's the only option that's given them. So it's most health problems that we face as a society today in the United Kingdom and the United States, around the world, most of these are lifestyle driven. The things we do in our life have huge power of wielding our wellness and improving our wellness, but yet that is not talked about largely. In some ways, I think the UK is probably better at it than the United States, but still we have so far to go to improve the wellness of our society.
Also, as well, like in the UK, and it's you know, I'm going off on a tangent here, away from ketogenic diet a little second, but I think it's important. In the UK, if you're a man in the UK, you never have to go to the doctors unless there's something wrong with you, right? Now, the same could be true of a woman as well, but they do get regular. I don't know what the time span is, but they'll get letters from the NHS to attend a smear test. So, you know, they're checking if they've got any cancer cells or whatever, almost like a mini MOT. But as a man, you don't get a mini MOT. So you grow up not afraid of the doctors, but it's kind of like a manly thing not to go to the doctors. And if you think about it, if you was like driving your car, you'd want to put it in for an MOT or what we call a service and check that it's all okay. And it wasn't until I stopped drinking alcohol, Will, and I started to learn more about health and supplementation and diet that I realized, wow, what I need for me and my body is going to be completely different from Will, Will's wife, Will's kids, my wife, my kids, you know. And so when it comes to Strive My Movement, it's very difficult for us to give a solution for the whole tribe. So for me, it becomes a bit like, okay, so what is my current physical state? Like, how does my blood work look, et cetera, et cetera? And then what do I need to do to either improve that, you know? And I can't find a very readily, easily accessible way to do that. Is this going to be the future? Like, I've just got some kind of device on my wrist and I look at it and it tells me all these things. And then I'm, you know, where are we going with this? And what is out there now for people that you're aware of, Will?
Yeah, so we are, most of my patients are just working class, normal people and I see a growing number of men more than ever. I've been doing this for about 10, 11 years at this point, and I have more guys interested in functional medicine than ever before. So I think times are changing in that way. And this is a conversation that, interestingly enough, I didn't know we were going to talk about this, but it's actually great that we are. I have a new podcast coming out through Goop, which is Gwyneth Paltrow's wellness brand. It's called Goop Fellas. It's a play on words of Goodfellas, but that's what it's about. It's about men's wellness and sort of raising the awareness for guys, because we see a growing number. I mean, we're seeing it both in our clinic, and Goop is seeing it in the number of people going to Goop.com interested in this stuff and wanting to have agency in their health and not just depend on ignoring it and thinking it'll go away, or just going to the doctor because they know they're just going to get a pill. So they want to actually take responsibility for their health, so to not go down the path of their fathers or their grandfathers. So this is an exciting time that we're living in. I think that the way that we're getting the information out with podcasts like this, it's really empowering guys and women. But guys are finally coming in and realizing what the women in their life have been telling them. You need to take this seriously. You need to take care of your health. You need to look at this wellness stuff that we're talking about. Guys are finally getting it. So it's just, we're at the cusp of something really amazing, I think, in our culture. And there's going to be a dichotomy of that too. I think a lot of times the other half will be guys not getting it still, but I think it's a growing amount that people are seeing this tipping point in our society. So as far as diagnostics and labs, I think that biohacking and different technology advancements, you will see people being able to measure biomarkers for themselves. And I think that's a good thing for people who want to do that. And we already have continuous glucose monitors and things for people that need them. And then biohackers that are just interested in looking at their blood sugar on an ongoing basis through an app on their phone. So yes, there's exciting ways. There's things like the Oura Ring and the other sort of rings and the bracelets that people wear to measure biometrics, to measure like biomarkers of their sleep and their activity levels, their blood sugar, et cetera. So we are definitely seeing advancements there as well.
I can imagine that'll be the next big Silicon Valley thing. There's probably some really smart people somewhere saying, right, how can we do this? Because it just seems insane that we wait until we're ill before we figure out, oh, okay, there's something wrong with me. I need to go fix it type of thing, rather than a continual, oh, let's just check in on how everything's operating in this wonderful machine of ours, you know?
Yeah.
So how did you get involved with, you know, all the ketogenic stuff then?
Yeah, so it's a tool that we have used in functional medicine for years. So I grew up knowing about the ketogenic. My dad was into wellness in the 80s and 90s and was into bodybuilding and all of that stuff. So I knew about that growing up, and then learning functional medicine, obviously knowing these are tools that one could use clinically for the past 10, 11 years. But I think that now what we're seeing is it's the keto diet, the ketogenic diet is having its sort of zeitgeist moment where people are aware of it. So it was my book, Ketotarian, which is a mostly plant-based ketogenic diet, was really my call to action. So let's do the keto diet in a smart way, in a clean way, in a sustainable way that makes sense for long-term human health and not just another fad crash diet that is a, you know, a here and gone, but something that can provide sustainable solutions for people. So it was born out of my clinical experience as a functional medicine practitioner and was also born out of my personal experience. I was a vegan for 10 years. And then I noticed, hey, my energy wasn't as good as it once was. I had some digestive issues with it. So my diet evolved to ketotarian. I didn't call it ketotarian then. This was in my late 20s. But it was a high-fat, lower-carb diet. And that's where Ketotarian, the book, kind of started, was with my own personal experience. So that's where it came from.
It's incredible to hear that it's been around for so long, because as with anything, it almost feels like it's brand new and it's fresh because of the way that it's been marketed. I think the first time I heard about it was possibly the Tim Ferriss podcast. He kept banging on about it. And I tend to switch off when it comes, but it gets all sciencey. So, you know, I'm just kind of like, give me something that works. I'll try it. And if that works, I'm good with it. But So yeah, it's really interesting and it's new. You talk about ketogenic diet improving brain function and decreasing chronic inflammation, which, you know, for me, certainly when I stopped drinking alcohol and I started to kind of, you know, pay more attention to my body, inflammation was a big one for me. Brain function, whenever you stop drinking alcohol, all of a sudden you start to wake up a little bit and, you know, you're a bit more perky in that area. And you do get a lot of people when they stop drinking going, when am I going to get this energy rush? When am I going to start thinking differently and all that kind of stuff? And I talk about diet and exercise a lot. So give us your informed opinion on how ketogenic diet improves these things.
Sure. So it's the ketogenic diet is allowing your body to produce ketones in a state called nutritional ketosis. And it's this natural metabolic state that all humans can tap into. And humans, again, would have been in times of ketosis for a long time, for eons, when times where carbs weren't as readily available or diets weren't higher in carbs just naturally, or there was not, there people were doing times of fasting due to food not being available, or just intentional fasting protocols that humans would have used throughout time for healing purposes. Now, this allows your body to burn ketones, which most people know it today as a way to lose weight, which it certainly is. It's becoming a fat burner. A lot of people can benefit from that. It's fantastic. Let that be their gateway into this way of eating, as long as they're doing it in a clean way, the way that I would advocate it, not just anything, as long as it's high fat, low carb. that's an important part to point to make, is that just because something's keto doesn't mean it's healthy. And that's really the conversation that I bring up in Ketotarian, is how to do this in a clean, sustainable way and not just go keto. Because I don't think that's necessarily healthy for long-term health. There can be this honeymoon period that somebody has with the conventional ketogenic diet, but what does the end game look like? What does this look like a year down the road, 2 years down the road, 5 years down the road? That's what I'm concerned with from a functional medicine standpoint. But the mechanisms are so much more than just losing weight, which can be someone's gateway into this way of eating. But the brain boosting and the anti-inflammatory benefits of a clean ketogenic diet is so much more exciting for me for a human wellness standpoint. And the mechanisms that are at play here, and I'll try to make this, not to make this super science-y, but basically it allows the ketone can pass through the blood-brain barrier and provide your brain clean fuel. And specifically how it's doing that, it's your mitochondria, your cells of your body can start burning ketones for fuel. So it's a very clean fuel in that standpoint, but it also helps to increase brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, actually helping your brain make new neurons. Not very many things can do that, but ketones, being in this fat-burning state, can do this for your brain. And it also, as you had mentioned, lowers inflammation. So that's brain inflammation, which is associated with brain fog and fatigue, anxiety, depression. So many guys, so many women can benefit from this. And just systemic lowering, systemic inflammation too, not just in the brain. But the mechanisms that are at play there is it lowers these pro-inflammatory cytokine pathways, like the NF-kappa-B pathway, the COX-2 pathway, and the NLRP3 inflammasome. So these are basically bad inflammatory pathways that are really higher. These proteins are higher in people with inflammatory issues, whether that's anxiety, depression, and brain fog, fatigue, like neurological inflammation, or autoimmune disease, heart disease, diabetes. Just about every health problem out there is inflammatory in nature, and ketones are a natural way to lower inflammation in a quite a powerful way. And then it upregulates these pro-antioxidant pathways, like the NRF2 pathway, the AMPK pathway. These are pathways that are really low with people with health problems. So it's sort of regulating it. It's bringing up the good antioxidant pathways and lowering those pro-inflammatory pathways. Again, all naturally using food as medicine, which is really the heart of functional medicine. But again, let's tap into this benefit of ketosis in a clean way, in a sustainable way. Because look, we're all good at 3 weeks of this or 4 weeks of that. Mm-hmm. Or you see people doing the conventional ketogenic diet, which is tends to be lots of meat and dairy. And there's going to be this honeymoon period where you're going to tap into those benefits that I just talked about. But what is the long-term goal here? So let's do it in how I would advocate, a mostly plant-based way. So you're eating, getting all the benefits of eating vegetables and good fiber, which is good for your microbiome, good for detoxification pathways. Clean, healthy fats, a lot of plant fats. And I offer pescatarian keto options too in Ketotarian, which is wild caught fish, which is good with good omega fats there too, but mostly in a plant centric way. So that's my, you know, my long winded answer for that of how it impacts inflammation and brain function.
And don't worry about me with the science. There's loads of people listening to this who like science, I guess. If I keep looking down, by the way, I'm making notes. I'm not texting my wife on the mobile phone. Not playing solitaire. I think you make a really good, important point about keto doesn't equal healthy, right? So it's the same like with vegan, isn't it? I remember going into a vegan joint once and I was getting really angry because they were selling vegan alcohol. Like, what the fuck are they selling alcohol for? Like, vegan's supposed to be healthy. And I'm like, no, vegan's not healthy. And it's the same with alcohol as well. And people give up drinking alcohol. All right, you can give up drinking alcohol and that is fantastic and you're increasing your health. But if then you fail to exercise and you just start eating a load of shit, then you know, it's not going to be the answer to everything.
Totally. We want to look at the quality of foods, not just the label that isn't always healthy. Yeah.
And talk about sustainability a little bit, because I think this is absolutely key, because what you're trying to sell here is a lifestyle, like a holistic wellness lifestyle option, not a fad diet. But your challenge is going to be sustainability and getting people to keep going with it. Talk a little bit about what challenges you've seen with people and how you can help people to make this a core part of their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really a fundamental aspect of Ketotarian in the book, because I've seen people come in with, you know, they're not sustainable with things. And I find that we can come up, well, I would say this, so let's go in order. The first way that I set them up for success is they have to get a good relationship with their head, like their themselves, their heart, get good relationships with their body, get good relationships with food. Because a lot of times people are going in and saying, oh, I'm really excited about whatever diet they're talking about. And then they go in and then they end up not finishing with it. They fail at it, or quote unquote fail at it. And they just, it adds to their pile of fad diets that they've tried or ways of eating that they've tried. I know how to, just seeing human behavior over the past 10 years, 11 years, and thousands of patients, and how people's relationships with their body and food impacts the sustainability of what they're doing. So I just, we talk a lot about the ethos, or like the why of why we're doing this. And this isn't about all the foods you can't have, but this is really about changing your relationship with your body and food and saying, how can I love my body enough to feed it good things? I want to feel better more than I want to have that food that makes me feel like crap. And I think that that's really that paradigm shift that people need to have, and realizing, what do they want out of life? What do they want out of their days? And really just kind of seize the day in a way that realizing every meal is an opportunity to feel great or to feel lousy. And what, you know, every food we eat is serving one or the other, some bigger in bigger ways and some in smaller ways, but largely there's no Switzerland meal. There's no, you know, completely neutral food where it's not doing one or the other. So I'm teaching people how to be mindful and conscious of the foods that they're having, and how to fuel your body to feel great. How can you feed yourself to feel great? And then from there, let's make it practical. Let's make it sustainable. And let's make it like delicious. Because if people are well fed, if it's easy enough to do, and they enjoy the food that they eat, that's the other aspect of sustainability. So all of those sort of thought processes along the way that I've seen, if someone's lacking in one area, they could trip them up. So we sort of solve that through the book, so people can really make this a sustainable part of their life.
It's super important. It's as you were talking, and I was realizing it's so very similar to alcohol, you know? So, you know, someone comes along to talk about alcohol and Strive, and we help them and we give them the tools and the knowledge. And then it's really up to them about, like, okay, how important is this for me now? You know, if I'm really stressed and I've got this bottle of beer, you know, do I need to succumb to that, like short term, or am I going to think more of long term? And I particularly like the one of, what does my body need right now? Like, does my body need this? And I think once you give up something like alcohol, or you really pare back what you're eating, and you do something like the ketotarian diet or some other diet, suddenly your body wakes up, doesn't it? It's like you'll eat something and you'll know that it's not quite right, or you'll get a blemish on your skin that you never saw before. And for me, when I was going for that malaise of going out drinking, boffing up, buying a kebab, eating takeaway food and processed food, I was never with it. Like, do you know what I mean? I was never, ever with it whatsoever.
Yeah, no, it's really giving people the ability to feel great. And what I've experienced is that when patients feel great, or people like readers of the book feel great, they would rather feel great than they miss anything they're lacking, you know, when anything they're not having anymore, I should say, because they're not lacking. They actually have everything that they need.
Yeah, it's almost like a combination of feeling great and looking great, which of course keto helps, because you start to lose weight. So you can, it's like, oh, wow, I'm losing weight and I feel good and I look good. People are telling me so.
Yeah,
you kind of get into a routine, don't you? You kind of like get into it. And this leads on to a quote in your book that I liked. It was that 90% of our longevity is determined by the choices we make, not our genetics. And it's the interaction between our genes and our environment that determines our health. So just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so when you're talking about chronic health problems in our world today, when you're talking about millions of people have, sadly, autoimmune condition, the rates of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, it's horrible statistics. Those things are, these chronic, degenerative, inflammatory health issues are largely, there are exceptions to that rule, but largely driven by lifestyle. So research estimates that the majority of how long that we live is by epigenetics. It's lifestyle factors, environmental factors that are constantly and dynamically instructing our genetics. So research estimates that our genetics, our DNA, haven't changed in 10,000 years. But what has changed is epigenetics. It's awakening these genetic predispositions that have laid latent, dormant for eons, but yet are being awoken like never before because of this onslaught of epigenetic triggers or modulators. So the foods that we're eating or the foods we're not eating, our stress levels, our exposure to environmental issues like toxins, all of these things are turning on these genetic predispositions. So genetics, the old view of genetics was, you know, if my mom had it or if my grandpa had it, you know, I was going to have this problem. It was just a matter of time. And now what research is saying, well, that's largely not true for most people. Most of the time, these are things that you have a lot of power that you wield over your life. It's really a message of self-responsibility, of empowerment, for people to start taking action on their health today to do the best they can with the access that they have to really improve their health.
Do you get a lot of cultural issues as well? Like, I can imagine back in the valley where I used to live in South Wales in the UK, if I try to get my mum and dad on a ketotarian diet, as he's, you know, he's putting his chips in, we call them chips, he fries it in a big deep fat fryer and they've got lard. My dad just looks at me sometimes and says, Lee, you're a knobhead. He calls me, not you're a knobhead, eating all his kale and all his stuff. Do you find a lot of cultural issues in LA?
You know what? My training's in LA. My wife is from Los Angeles, but I am in Pittsburgh, which is probably close to South Wales. People don't call me a knobhead, but probably do behind my back. But the reality that I've seen, you know, living in a working class steel city, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from the country outside of Pittsburgh as well. It is growing like never before. You'd be surprised. And I'm in a unique position that most of my patients are online. I talk to people around the world and I see so many people, men and women in small towns, waking up to this. I talk to patients that work on ranches or they, you know, work in a little hospital. She's a nurse in a hospital in a small town that are just realizing what they're doing is not working for them and people are waking up. So it's slow. I definitely, if you're not in a, like in the United States, if you're not in LA or New York or maybe London, you're right. There's probably less of a concentrated amount of people that are interested in wellness, but it's happening around the world.
Another thing on environment, I know you were talking more of epigenetics related to environment, but physical environment is super important as well, right? So I'm currently in Cardiff. I live in Cardiff. If I want to go out and like the other day, I wanted a smoothie, right? I went to one shop. They weren't doing smoothies on that day. That was it. I was done. There was no other smoothie that I would find in the capital of Wales, right? Mm-hmm. So your environment and where you live in terms of getting organic food and all that kind of stuff, that could be quite a challenge as well, can't it?
It can. You have to do the best you can. Resources like the Environmental Working Group or the EWG has great resources where they update it yearly, the famous Clean 15 and the Dirty Dozen list. So basically, if you don't have access to all organic, shop from the Clean 15 list so you can buy conventional and just wash it off. But the Dirty Dozen list, that tends to be higher in pesticides and herbicides. It's not so clean. So you want to we would advise to get organic whenever possible for that Dirty Dozen list. But you're right, it's not always an option. But you have to do the best you can. And what I have found is that patients do, the more they put into it, the more they're going to get out of it. Nobody's perfect. This isn't about being dogmatic and saying, well, you have to do this entirely or it's not going to do anything. I find this really, if people push into it and make some tiny changes, it can wield so much power and influence over their physiology, their biochemistry, or their health, their wellness. So this is not something that I have seen. I have seen many, many patients. Most of my patients don't have the best access to stuff, whether financial or geographic or, you know, whatever reason, maybe just health-wise, they can't even get out and do stuff. We live in a time where things are more accessible than ever to normal everyday people. And I find that is sometimes people can keep that that mental block and keep them from making action steps. Well, I can't do that. That's only for wealthy people. That's only for people that live in the city. And what do? They just don't know how to do it. So if they can, I have never seen it be somewhere where somebody in a small town on fixed income couldn't figure out how to make these changes. We have shopping plans for people on a budget on the website, and that's just free on the site. And what I have found too is when people are healthier and they feel better, their quality of life goes up, and they aren't spending money on all the junk food that they waste their money on anyways. The amount of money that people spend their money on, the things that don't matter. When they start reshifting their priorities, they realize they have more disposable income in many cases than they realized. And then they lower their healthcare costs too many times, where they aren't spending their money on all the copays, the medications, or the doctor's visits, and they're spending it on their health instead.
Yeah, it's very different in the UK and the US. But I know that, for example, when I started to get healthier, and my wife, who's from California, was a big influence on that. You know, I was the type of person, and she would say, "Is that cucumber organic?" And I'd be like, "What the fuck? It's just a cucumber." But then it's when I read stuff like from you and other people and other experts, and I start to realize that pesticides and the toxicity of just walking down the street with all that, and all that stuff is like creating inflammation stuff. And I start to wake up a little bit. Online shopping, super important for me, you know, finding really good health stores online. And also, I always say to people say to me, "Wow, isn't it cost you a lot of money to be healthy and take supplements and eat a vegan lifestyle and stuff?" And I'm like, "Well, it does, but I can afford it because I don't drink, right?" So if I was a drinker drinking alcohol, what was I spending? Probably 100 to 150 pounds a week on alcohol and the junk food that I would drink after the alcohol. I mean, come on, like, you know, you can buy yourself some organic cucumbers by knocking out your alcohol. So we'll talk about alcohol a little bit. How does alcohol fit into a ketotarian lifestyle?
So it's interesting, right? I mean, talking to patients and talking about alcohol and the people's relationship with alcohol comes up oftentimes in my clinic. And this is separate than ketotarian, but I do find it's interesting where I almost feel like alcoholism or people with substance abuse, that's on a spectrum as well, as that many times people think they don't fit all the boxes of a quote unquote alcoholic, but yet they have to go home when they get home and they have to have that glass of wine because they're basically using it to manage their stress and anxiety or depression. And I find that alcoholism, and I'm by no means an expert on alcoholism, but I would say from a functional medicine standpoint, I see this dependency as a spectrum. That not everybody's a full-blown alcoholic where they're fitting all the criteria, but there's a lot of functioning alcoholics to a certain degree out there. So we have that conversation oftentimes. But in the book, we say to have no alcohol for the initial 8 weeks. To give their liver the best chance to start producing ketones, which is what's producing ketones, and just overall just lowering inflammation levels, helping their body, helping their gut health, which could be impacted from alcohol as well. And then after that, if they want to have small amounts of it occasionally, I think if someone can have a healthy relationship with alcohol, that's maybe something for somebody. So that's my stance on it in the book.
It's a little bit of a paradox, though, isn't it? Because I should imagine when you're trying to influence somebody to introduce a ketotarian lifestyle, so, you know, this is a great way of kind of like taking care of yourself. And in the first 8 weeks, we don't want you to drink alcohol. Then the people on that spectrum, we in our training and experiences, we call it the alcohol spectrum, right? So at one end, you've got Auntie Dot, who drinks once a year at Christmas, and then the other end, you've got a raving alcoholic who's pissing his pants on a street corner. And then the spectrum's like this, right? So he's up there, he's down here, and she's up there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I guess the people who are more up towards Auntie Dot, they're not going to have an issue. So you're going to talk to them about this, and you can say, "Don't you have any alcohol after, you know?" And they're going to be like, "Well, that's cool with me." And they're, I'm guessing it, but I imagine, you know, they're more likely to be healthier than the people who are like, Oh, I'm not stopping drinking alcohol for 2 months. And of course, if you want to have this to be sustainable, if that person, the people who are going to have the problem giving up for 2 months and the people who are not going to be able to introduce alcohol into their lifestyle in a small way, they're the ones who, you know, they have a glass, they're going to have to drink a bottle. So I imagine that and sugar are kind of like your two big problems, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say there's a lot of people that are on that spectrum that they have this sort of, they have a panic attack, mini panic attack, sometimes a full-blown panic attack with even the thought of not being able to come home and have that drink. So that's definitely something where they're going to have to take inventory on their life and their heart and their soul and their mind about why they are doing what they're doing and what do they want to get out of this? Where are they at on that decision-making process to start making some healthier choices in their life? And that is one of them. So if I had to say, it would be sugar, alcohol for some people, and grains would be the other thing. A lot of times people are addicted to their pastas and their breads and their cereals. And when you don't have that for 8 weeks, that can create the same sort of a panic attack as alcohol for some people.
Yeah. It's crazy. And I guess it, again, when the thing with a diet or like a cleanse is people can look at it and they think it's manageable because, oh, can I do this? I can do this. I just done like a 9-day liver cleanse, right? So I'm like, I could do a 9-day liver cleanse. I've done an 8-week one before. I could do that. 9 days is okay. But now I'm just about to do a 90-day thyroid cleanse. And I'm thinking 90 days. And my boy said, that's like a third of the year. And then you start thinking to yourself, you know, I've got to make this my life. So now you start thinking about your life and now the resistance kicks in and I'm going to drop the book and Will doesn't know what he's talking about. And I think I'll just carry on doing what I'm doing. As I'm talking to you, sustainability and getting people to think long-term, like what do I want to drink this alcohol right now? What, you know, right now, is that going to really help me or not? You know, I mean, send them to me, Will. You send them to me and I'll sort the alcohol problem out and then you can turn them into ketotarian
monsters.
I love it. Why does dairy get such a bad rap? My boy, I told you earlier on, I don't really know much about the science. I'm one of these people. My wife says to me sometimes, she'll ask me something like, does the sun revolve around the earth or does the earth revolve around the sun? And I'll say, I don't know. Why am I supposed to know that? And she says, well, you're supposed to be reasonable, be intelligent. And I'll be like, I haven't got time to squeeze shit like that in my head because I've got too much to put in there. So my boy says to me, Dad, you don't eat dairy. Why don't you eat dairy? And I say, I don't know, son. I don't know. All I know is I ain't going to get down a sucker cow's titty. To me, it's just common sense. But I can't explain it to him. Will, explain to him why he shouldn't be drinking milk.
Yeah, right. I love that. So the... Some people can handle dairy fine, right? Some people don't have dairy sensitivities. They don't have casein sensitivities. They're not lactose intolerant. The quality of dairy is actually more of a problem than the dairy itself. So it's the crossbreeding of cows, which that now has a new casein or dairy protein in it. So it's called beta A1 casein. And it's a mismatch between that beta A1 casein and our genetics. So again, our genetics haven't changed predominantly almost exclusively for 10,000 years, but yet that beta A1 casein, that new dairy protein that's in most of the cows that people are drinking in the US and the UK, that's causing this sort of reactivity and this inflammation, which is again, the common link between just about every health problem. So there's that problem. And then what we're feeding the cows. So they're eating corn and soy and all this grain when they're meant to be grazing. They're meant to be grass-fed. So it's both the crossbreeding the cows, the diet the cows fed, and then obviously the antibiotics and the hormones that they're giving them as well. So it's really the modernization of the cow industry, farming industry, more than the dairy itself. Because you can get decent, and you'll see this cropping up in the United States, and I'm sure in the UK as well, where you can get A2 milk or A2 cheeses and things like that. So I think that if you get good quality dairy, there's people that people that have problems with the regular conventional dairy don't have problems with that dairy. And then the other aspect of it too is that they're not having the dairy fat, which tends to be less problematic. So they're not having the creams or the, you know, the ghee, like the clarified butter, that's the traditional sort of Indian approach. they're not having that. They're just having straight up milk, all, you know, too much of it. So I think if people have the better forms of it, maybe the cultured yogurts or the kefirs or the things like that, tends to be way better, and it gets some benefits from that over the just drinking milk. And then there's people that you get the best of the best dairy out there, the organic, grass-fed, all that stuff. They still have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. So the depends on the person too. And that's really the heart of functional medicine, is seeing what works and what doesn't for the individual. With that said, ketotarian is dairy-free. The only exception is ghee or clarified butter, which again, the casein tends to be more problematic. I don't enjoy dairy for the most part, so I agree with you. I just don't, doesn't go for me. But it's one of those things too, when you take dairy out, for some people, it's like this visceral reaction against not having dairy. There's so many other options. There's coconut milk and almond milk and hemp milk that taste really good. And you can get a lot of the same products with it as well.
Yeah, I remember listening to some behemoth bodybuilder on the Rich Roll podcast. He was a vegan monster. Like, he was like King Kong, but he was a vegan. And he said that he really struggled to get off dairy because it's addictive. Now, I never had that problem, but if you think about it logically, any kind of milk that is coming from an animal or a human is going to be addictive. I mean, I got a 2-year-old daughter, man, she won't leave my wife's boobs alone, right? So you can see the addiction there. It's got to be created that way to get you addicted to it, because it's Mother Nature didn't design it for us to drink it like water. Designed toddlers to drink it to get the best out of it. And what better way to convince your toddler to drink it than to make it addictive? So, I can imagine that dairy, sugar. I mean, I'm no expert, but I imagine there's something in bread as well that is addictive. Yeah.
There are proteins that make it addictive for some people than others, but also too, it breaks down into sugar too, and sugar is addictive as well.
Mm. What about sugar in a ketotarian lifestyle?
Yeah, so it wouldn't have a home in ketotarian land for sure. It's can drive dysglycemia. It obviously drives insulin resistance and inflammation. It's not good for the microbiome. So we go for, it's a high fat, moderate protein, lower carb, mostly plant-based ketogenic diet. So the sweeteners would be like lower fructose fruits, like berries, citrus fruits, like lemons, limes, things like that, grapefruit. There's a lot of low-carb natural sweeteners like stevia or stevia, monk fruit, xylitol, sugar alcohols that can provide these sort of clean, lower-carb sweetening desserts and things like that and for ketotarian.
And just sharing some of my personal experience here for some of you that are listening. When it comes to quitting alcohol, and you know, all my audience will know it, we talk about the resistance a lot, right? So we talk about, we want to quit drinking alcohol, and all of a sudden this thing comes up in our head and it's like, nah, you're not fucking giving up drinking. You know, your life won't be worth living. Well, the same type, this resistance comes up when we want to, you know, change and introduce a ketotarian lifestyle, for example. So, you know, you might try almond milk with your cereal one morning. I'm saying cereal, but you know, you might try almond milk with something, and you'll tell yourself, well, this doesn't taste like milk. This is awful. Or you might try stevia and you'd be like, this doesn't taste like sugar. But in my personal experience, if that is true, but if you keep at it, your taste buds will adapt. And before you know it, you'll be like, oh, give me half a glass of really nice almond milk, because you've adapted. So a lot of it is about just sticking with it and trusting that your body will eventually adapt to this, you know, these new foods, because for most of us, everything is just so sugarified that we're, you know, our taste buds are like, boom, it hasn't got sugar and I can't eat it. It's disgusting.
Yeah, it is. It's really messed with our minds. And there's been some really interesting research looking at how the food industry has manufactured food to be very addictive and in a very intentional way from a sales standpoint. So it is tapping into the human mind and messing with it to become a constant consumer of it. As people are separating themselves from that and focusing on real nutrient-dense, healthy food that's in alignment with our genetics, it reshifts our hormones and we start to reclaim that independence away from that hangriness and that food addiction.
Hangriness. I remember my wife telling me she was hangry once when she shouted at her. I said, what a load of nonsense that is. Hangry. You just made that up. And then I realized that she didn't make it up.
It's a thing.
Mate, I feed her all the fucking time now. Like, I never let her get hungry, because if she gets hungry, I've had it. Talk about drinking water, because I'm 44 now. I pee all the time. So I try not to drink water because I don't want to pee all the time. I'm trying to change. What? How important is water, and how can I stop peeing myself all the time?
You can wear an adult diaper. You can, that'll help. Well, drinking water is good. And depends on how much water you're drinking, I guess. Is the amount of water you're drinking directly proportional to the amount of time someone's going to the bathroom? I think that's important too, because sometimes frequent urination can be a sign of something else, like insulin resistance, diabetes. Not saying that's your case. But if someone's drinking lots of water, they can expect to drink more, to go to the bathroom more. But something to keep in mind here, that there's something called gel water, which is not really talked about a lot, but exciting research around gel water, which is found in real foods. So things like chia seeds and vegetables and fruits, they have this sort of different compound of water that's actually in many ways more hydrating than water, H2O. So I find that people focus more on real foods that have this gel water innately in it. They tend to need less water, and they're not going to be peeing so much. Mm. So, but they'll be quite hydrated. So that's something to consider, is just focusing on more real foods, and you can get that deep hydration that people need, but don't require them to be having like 16 glasses of water a day.
I used to drink a lot of tea, try to make them herbal, like hibiscus and things like that. And I used to think to myself, do I need to drink like pints and pints of water in addition to my tea? Or does the tea count as my quota of water?
Tea counts as water. Now, I mean, if it's black tea, green tea, white tea, and obviously coffee, there is a slight diuretic component to that. But herbal tea, for the most part, these are not major diuretics. I mean, there are certain herbs that are, but for the most part, even the green tea, the white tea, black tea, there's mild diuretic for most people, that you're still being hydrated. In my opinion, it still should be counted towards water. And then you should have a couple of glasses of just pure water itself as well.
Right. I'm going to finish off talking about the medical medium, right? Because one thing for sure, in all industry, there's always going to be counter views, right? I mean, it's the same in alcohol, you know, like Alcoholics Anonymous think that it's a brain disease and it's genetic, and, you know, and they use terms alcohol, alcoholics and alcoholism. We don't, right? It's like a different view. I read your book, and I did the ketogenic diet for a while. I started to get some bloating. And at the same time that I got some bloating, I was considering just reaching out to you and saying, hey, maybe what's going on? I was going to do a food log and stuff, but I didn't. My wife said, oh, you should try this medical medium guy, right? So I said, okay, we'll give it a look. And if you're struggling with keto, suddenly this medical medium guy seems to be your knight in shining armor, because he's telling you to, like, if for example, you're like a sweet tooth and you know the fruit kind of stuff, and you're trying to count your berries, and he's going, whack it down, you get as much sugar as you can. I guess the thing that I wanted to ask you about was, in the keto thing, it was all very much like avocados, coconut. Like, I was eating a lot of healthy fats. Like, I was waking up in the morning, I was slamming them in my smoothie, and I was doing it all. And then I read the medical medium, and he's like, no, cut all that fat out. Don't have that in the morning, because you're going to fuck your liver up. You're going to give it too much work. Do those healthy fats later on in the afternoon. And then basically I did this liver cleanse diet with him, and it was just literally all fruit and vegetables, with lots of fruit. So, you know, the guy's taken over the celery industry right now. He's even got a book coming out of celery. What's your views on what he's trying to teach people? I'm interested in what you've got to say about it.
Sure. So first of all, and I know that you know this because you read the book, but how I advocate in ketotarian is to go 8 weeks, mostly plant-based keto. And then from there, people can kind of find their sweet spot in personalization. So we talk about seasonal ketotarian and doing increasing their carbs maybe in the summer, having lower carbs. And that's from an ancestral health standpoint. Many people's ancestors would have done similar things. We also talk about a cyclical ketotarian where you go cycle in and out of ketosis and increase your fruits and starchy foods, tubers and things like that. The other remaining days of the week, like 4 to 5 days in ketosis, the remaining days moderating or increasing your carbs. And then some people can stay in ketosis longer term. And they, some people need to, neurological insulin resistance, inflammatory issues would maybe benefit with longer term ketosis. And then some people just do it when they need a reset. So I don't think that in my mind, at least when I was writing Ketotarian, I didn't want me to seem, I think there's a place for people that have a carb tolerance. They're not super insulin resistant. They can handle higher carbs in the form of real foods, whole foods, fruit, higher starch vegetables and fruits, and even like rice, where they do better with that. But they've built that initial metabolic flexibility over those initial 8 weeks of being ketotarian that they can leverage those benefits of those carbs, but still go in and out of ketosis when they want to. That I feel is where I want every human to be. Not everybody has that ability because they have been insulin resistant or going through health problems for a long time. But like for myself, I do that. I do a cyclical ketotarian approach and I'm fine with that. Mm-hmm. And I want people to build that for themselves using those initial 8 weeks in the book. With that said, I think that Anthony William, right? That's the medical medium. I don't know him personally. He's a good friend of a friend of mine, Alejandro Younger, who is wrote the foreword to his books. And Alejandro, I just had to go off of what Alejandro says. And Alejandro told me that he's a great guy. He's helped a lot of people. In my mind, I think that there's a middle ground. I think that there's sort of all these sort of polar opposite, like extreme views of things. And I feel like the truth is normally somewhere in the middle and context matters. And I think that there's a lot of good stuff that can come from his book. And there's a lot of truth that's in his book, anecdotally. And I could see people that would get benefits from that. I don't think that, for example, I don't think Epstein-Barr virus is the cause of every problem under the sun. But at the same time, the other view is conventional medicine saying we don't ever look at viruses. Yeah. I run the labs in functional medicine, and I would agree with the medical medium that I see chronic viral infections a lot. It's not every patient, but it's a lot of people. So I find that nuance matters, context matters, and these things need to be talked about. It's hard to encapsulate that in the book. And I've never sat down with Anthony William and kind of talked about the fact that we are all different. And that's really the heart of functional medicine. I think he's shedding light on something that is amazing. The concept of viruses, the concept of using food as medicine. And if that's people's window into real food, I think that's a good thing. And then from there, they can evolve and find out what works for them. But I could tell you, eating tons of fruits all day long can really mess some people's digestion up, can impact some people's blood sugar up, and it's not going to work for them. So does that mean that Anthony Williams' advice is wrong? No, it just means that how can you get the truth that's in that book to make it work for your body? Mm. And some, again, that's hard to encapsulate biological individuality and bio variability of every person in a book. So that's not Anthony Williams' fault. That's every book that's out there's fault. We can't encapsulate every nuance out there under the sun. So with that said, I think it's great. I think that we just need to find out how can we get the nuggets of truth that works for you in that book. And I think celery juice can I use that in my functional medicine practice for people. I think it can be really good at rebuilding hydrochloric acid and helping digestion. But for some people, celery juice, it'll flare up their digestion up.
Yeah.
So because it's a higher FODMAP and people with SIBO, it'll cause these flare ups. So does that make celery juice not good? No, let's find out where it's appropriate and use it there. So that's my take on his stuff.
Yeah, I think when I started to do some of the recipes in your book, and then I started to get a little bit bloated, I noticed that actually when I switched to Auntie William's stuff, I still got the same bloating. I think I nailed it down to cauliflower for some reason. Like every time I had cauliflower, I would be like belching, and my belly would, even just thinking about cauliflower, I'd get a big belly. Yeah, I I think what happens is, for me anyway, and what I see in the alcohol is, I was doing an article yesterday. I was writing an article about poker, right? About how human beings are drawn to lists. Right? Why are we drawn to the 50 this, the 10 this, the, you know? And psychologically, it's because it puts things in order for us, so we don't have to think about shit, right? And so I think what happens is, when somebody in Strive says, hey, this ketotarian lifestyle is really working for me, you should buy Dr. Will Kolb's book, which is what happened. And I would say, in my community, the vast majority of people who are trying to integrate a new lifestyle are going ketotarian, and are discussing ketotarian on the forums all the time. What happens is, we pick up the book and we just want to follow the rules, man. We don't want to know, like, we don't want to know the science. We don't want to understand. We just want to follow the rules to fix ourselves. Yeah. And then this other book comes up. Now we just want to follow those rules. What you're saying, which is really important, and I want everybody listening to this to think about this, is to pick up the best things that work for you from lots of variety of different sources, implement them. And then keep I think really important, we haven't talked about it, food logging, like keep a log of what we're eating. So when we are feeling a little bit shitty, we can say, oh, kind of like, what were we eating there? So I think going back, back to the beginning, isn't it, about personal specifications, like, super important.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And it takes, that's not a sexy answer, right? It's because it's not cookie cutter. Mm. But you start with the cookie cutter, that's like a plan in a book. But then from there, you have to make it your own. So that's why I tried to say, after those 8 weeks, these are some ideas of how to make this your own. So, because I realized saying everybody needs to be in ketosis forever and ever is not the solution. So, but how can you use this and leverage this, get metabolic flexibility, and then personalize it? And that takes self-experimentation, trying things out, seeing what works and what doesn't in the context of wellness.
Also, really important, if you're listening to this, is why it's more beneficial to follow Will's advice and not the medical medium's, is in 90 days time, after I'd done my thyroid cleanse, which is part of what Anthony Williams is promoting in his thyroid book, I'm going to march into the NHS doctors and I'm going to say, hey, doc, I want to reduce my level of thyroxine. And the doc's going to say, oh yeah, Lee, why is that then? Well, this guy was having a chat with Spirit up in the sky, and Spirit told him that Epstein-Barr virus is actually why I'm having such a problem. There's nothing wrong with my thyroid, it's EBV. So Spirit is telling me that I don't need to take my level of thyroxine. And the NHS doctor is going to look at me and fucking wheel me straight to the asylum. Obviously, I'm joking a little bit. I'm joking a little bit there. But yeah. How do you, or do you incorporate the more woo-woo kind of... I mean, we do get a bit woo-woo here at Truth About Alcohol and Strive. We're big fans of Joe Dispenza's meditations and rewiring our brain to think differently about alcohol. So, you know, really looking at the future, about what our future is with alcohol, and then feeling that and then bringing it back into the present. So we do a bit of woo-woo, but I'm interested in your woo-woo angle from
your like background. So I think that I'm a very spiritual person, but I from a clinical functional medicine standpoint, it's hard to substantiate or prove right or wrong when you're saying Spirit told you, right? There's no real peer-reviewed literature in the back. And look, all scientific literature has its limitations. And some people would call functional medicine woo-woo, and that's definitely a criticism that hardcore, that people that really don't know what they're talking about, hardline conventional medicine advocates would say something about functional medicine. Mm. So I want to give Anthony Williams and that grace to say, look, he's helping people. He's really not hurting anybody significantly. He's doing what he thinks works for people. But for me, I don't know that personally to be true, that something's like just telling him and that's exactly the gospel truth. I don't know if that is the case. But I think that spirituality as a whole, what for oneself, a connection to something greater. There's a lot of exciting research showing people that have that connection with something greater. It improves health outcomes. They tend to live longer, healthier, more enjoyable lives. And community is part of that too. And I think that those are the type of things that I have seen both in my own life and in patients' lives, patients that are connected with the community, patients that have a higher purpose. And it doesn't have to be religion. It can be just mindfulness meditation and breathing and just realizing you're part of nature and part of a larger beyond yourselfness. It can be enough. But I find that people that are very... Let's say they don't believe in anything beyond just what's around them. They don't really have any higher purpose. They don't have community. These people tend to be jaded and bitter. They heal slower. And then every step along the way is miserable because of that outlook on life. So I think that's how I would see it in the context of functional medicine.
Yeah, I'm a very much stick my finger up in the air kind of guy. And when I read these articles that say, hey, people who drink alcohol live longer than people who don't drink alcohol. You know, first of all, I'm thinking, what a load of shit. But then I have to back it up in an argument with somebody who's using it as a resistance tool to keep drinking. And for me, I think I can imagine a lot of people who's like, let me give you an example. I took my son yesterday to watch John Wick 3, right? Which, by the way, if you like a lot of violence, which is not necessarily spiritually good for you, doesn't really get your cells working really well, go and watch John Wick. I don't think Anthony Williams will watch it, but I went and watched it. And we were in the build-up watching the adverts. There was four, not one, not two, not three, but four alcohol adverts before my 18-year-old son had even got the John Wick. And I said to my boy after the first one, you watch what each one of these has in common. And fair play to him. He nailed it. Community. Every single one was selling the idea of community. And I think if when you stop drinking alcohol, it's natural then to drift away from your community, because community, we talked about environment earlier on, is all in the pub, and we don't want to go to the pub, we don't want to be around these people. But if you just leave yourself on your own and you don't go and find another community, of course you're probably going to end up knocking some years off your life, right? So again, keto is not healthy alone on its own. Veganism isn't healthy on its own. Alcohol, it's a wide variety of different contributory factors. And I think listening to people like Dr. Wokol, the medical medium, listening to this podcast, just keep growing, man. Keep learning, trying, trying different things, isn't it? That's what it's all about, isn't it, Will?
Yeah, great advice. I agree with you.
And finally, how does living the keto lifestyle, your cyclical keto lifestyle, make you feel?
I have increased energy. I have good brain function. I feel centered, which is important for me. So that's how I feel.
And I've got to say, I've got a bit of a man crush on you. You're looking fantastic as well, Will. Your wife is a very lucky woman.
Likewise.
Oh, women, by the way, if you are listening to this podcast, get over to YouTube and you can see Will's lovely face there. Okay, thank you for joining as well.
Thank you.